Hello, you're listening to Wine Blast with me, Susie Barry, and my husband and fellow master of wine, Peter Richards. Welcome. Thank you for giving us the precious gift of your time and company, which we very much appreciate.
And we won't let you down, I promise. In fact, we are going to repay you handsomely with an absolute treat of an episode. Actually, the start of a new occasional series, peeking behind the scenes, behind the facades of the most iconic wine estates in the world. And in this programme, we're locking onto the wine legend that is Sassicaia.
It's a big one.
Yes.
It is a big one.
Come on.
And all we ask you to do in return for this gift, by the way, is to recommend the pod to all your wine-loving friends and family. Help us spread the word and the wine love. Yes. They will thank you in the long run. In this episode, we are talking Italy. We're talking rebellious Bordeaux blends. Mm. But really, we're talking about how a couple of outsiders came to a disregarded corner of Italy and created out of absolutely nothing what we might term an accidental icon.
Oh, love that. Love that. I think that really captures the real essence of this story. Fundamentally, you know, it's not a tale of design or ambition. It's a story about serendipity, born out of the humble aspirations of a true wine lover who was actually busy with other stuff like breeding horses and setting up a wildlife reserve. And this is a wine which over time has managed to stay true to its roots despite enjoying quite remarkable success.
It hasn't all been plain sailing, though. What with being targeted by fraudsters and somewhat controversial price rises of late. But these are all things that we'll come on to in good time. But first up, here's a taster of what's in store.
It's special in a way that it's a bit mysterious. People just fell in love with not only the wine itself, but also the story.
I mean, let's not kid ourselves. It's Sassicaia. It's an expensive bottle of wine. But in the world of fine wine, in the world of icon wine, it still offers very, very good value for money.
It's very important. Family owned, down to earth, very little marketing, but the bottle and the glass talk, the wine talk by itself, basically.
Priscilla Incisa della Rocchetta there, granddaughter of Mario, the original creator of Sassicaia. Also Brett Fleming, managing director of Armit, the UK agent for Sassicaia. And finally, master sommelier Nicolas Clerc, who also works with Armit. We'll be hearing more from all of them in due course.
Now, it's important to say from the outset that our aim here is not to fangirl or gush about what's an already celebrated wine. We want to hear from the key people and get a sense for what really goes on behind the scenes, what makes this operation tick, why the wine is as it is, and present a fresh perspective that goes beyond the myth or the legend.
Absolutely. So we've visited, we've tasted, we've read and trawled through endless notes. Most importantly, we've sat down and listened. And that's what forms the basis of our programme today. So let's get going. And the first thing to say is that Sassicaia is the name of the wine. The wider estate is called Tenuta San Guido. And that's an important distinction to make, isn't
absolutely, it? Absolutely, absolutely. So to set the scene, our story takes place on the west coast of Tuscany, north of Rome and west of Florence and Siena. Back in the day, this area, called the Maremma, was malaria-ridden marshland, backwater compared to the noble lands of Chianti country further inland. It was used for livestock and crops. And it just happened that one notable landowner around the small town of Bolgheri was one of the oldest families in Tuscany, whose ancestor, Count Ugolino, appears in Dante's The Divine Comedy. And they were the Della Gherardesca family.
Yeah, so in 1930, Contessa Clarice della Gherardesca married Marchese Mario Incisa della Rocchetta, whose family were originally from Piedmont. And they, together, took over her part of the family lands in the Maremma. It was a 2,500-hectare estate called Tenuta San Guido.
Now, the plan was nothing to do with wine. It was about breeding thoroughbred horses. And this coastal strip of land is mostly pretty flat and apparently quite springy in places. So good for horses to run on. Plus, you've got agricultural land to grow the feed. You know, they bred Ribo, apparently the horse of the 20th century, and an icon of the equine world. Not that we know much about these sort of things.
Absolutely nothing, but, you know, cue lots of puns about Italian stallions. That's sort of our level, isn't it?
I don't think we'd stoop... quite stooped to that.
Well, you wouldn't, mate.
I wouldn't, but anyway, Mario also loved nature, so he set up one of the first wildlife sanctuaries in Italy, which still exists as a WWF reserve in the coastal reaches of the estate. Mm. And it's a haven for all kinds of migrating birds, among other things.
So birds and horses, two things we know absolutely nothing about. Well, we do know about his wine, but that's where we come back to Mario, because Mario was many things, among them, wine lover. He had a soft spot for Bordeaux, and he'd enjoyed similar Cabernet Sauvignon-based reds with their wonderful bouquet, as he termed it, made just up the road in Pisa by the Salviati family. So he asked the Salviatis, when he took over the estate, for some Cabernet Sauvignon vines and planted the first few hectares of the Castiglioncello vineyard in the hilliest inland plot of the San Guido estate in the early 1940s. Importantly, he planted them over gravelly soils, which is where the name of the wine comes from. Sasso means rock, and Aia means located in.
It's an urban myth, isn't it, that the vines came from Lafitte.
Indeed.
Anyway, more vines, including Cabernet Franc to blend with the Cabernet Sauvignon, would follow in due course. But it's important to remember that this was never conceived as a commercial project. Mm. The wine was purely for home consumption, friends and family only. And so it stayed from 1945 to 1967.
Yeah, and apparently the first vintages didn't go down hugely well. I think it's fair to say that opinion was mixed. Mm. You know, there had been wine in these parts before, but it was pretty basic, pretty light stuff, you know, made from the local Sangiovese, Canaiolo or Trebbiano grapes. This newfangled red made from foreign grapes may just have been a bit too much, a bit too sort of fierce and Frenchified, dare I say it.
But that said, as we know, Mario had been putting away the odd case in his cellars. Mm. And with time, the wine improved and started to win admirers, didn't
it? Yeah, it did.
The well-known wine critic, Luigi Veronelli, was an early fan, encouraging the family to really think big with Sassicaia. Yeah.
Now, another key figure in the Sassicaia story is winemaker Giacomo Takis. He'd been making wine for the Antinori family in Tuscany, who are also related to the Della Gherardescas, and who inherited lands next door to Sassicaia or San Guido.
And these are the estates that went on to produce wines like Ornellaia and Guado Altasso.
Exactly,
they?
But it's starting to get a bit confusing. Isn't it?
It really is.
Another story.
Too
so
many
we'll just
names.
Park that for a bit. But anyway, from the late 60s onwards, Giacomo Takis modernised the viticulture and winemaking of Sassicaia. He introduced things like stainless steel tanks for the fermentation to prevent spoilage and enable temperature control. He was also keen on using small oak barrels for aging and maturation to help soften the wine and give it more complexity.
So over time, Takis would go on to be celebrated as one of the most influential Italian winemakers ever, partly or largely, I would say, for his work at Sassicaia. Yeah. It's worth remembering he was from Piedmont too, like Mario. Mm. Although I understand that Takis got on better with Niccolo, the son, than the Marchese Mario.
didn't Mario do like a rebellious side project or something like that?
He did. So both these quite determined men didn't always see eye to eye. And there is a funny story about how Mario, having had to defer to Takis' superior technical knowledge, decided to make a secret Sassicaia cuvée as a sort of a side hustle. So he used his beloved wooden vats to ferment rather than Takis' stainless steel, and 4 years aging in barrels to make a really old school wine called Il Vino Diverso della Sassicaia. But long story short, it fell by the wayside as the official Sassicaia blossomed.
Intriguing. Il Vino Diverso della Sassicaia. Secret Sassicaia. Love that. But, I mean, wasn't the official Sassicaia's first release onto the wider market in 1971? No, with the 68 vintage.
Yeah, exactly. Although the 1968 was actually a blend of vintages put together by Takis with Mario. Largely, though, to be honest, 1968. Mm, mm. And incidentally, the Antinoris, going back to them, helped market the wine initially.
Now, it took a while for international recognition to come, but come it did. In 1978, a blind tasting of Cabernet wines in London with Hugh Johnson, our friend Hugh, for Decanter magazine, saw Sassicaia take first spot, and this for the difficult, rainy 1972 vintage, but that's a hallmark of the estate, making good wines out of indifferent vintages. Since then, further recognition has followed. The 1985 vintage was given 100 points by American critic Robert Parker. The 2015 vintage was championed in 2018 by Wine Spectator magazine, and both the 2016 and 2021 again have earned 100 Parker points.
So what started out as a bit of a punt by a wine lover keen to see if he could recreate his favourite tipple, a cheeky tip of the hat to Bordeaux, on his estate in coastal Tuscany for personal consumption after a hard day's work with the horses, ended up becoming a superstar wine estate with 115 hectares of vines and a stellar reputation.
Yeah, what's interesting is how the wine world has kind of moved with them. In the way that true pioneers do. You know, they move the world rather than the other way around. So initially, Sassicaia had to be sold as a vino da tavola, you know, the lowest classification in Italian wine.
And that was because it was made from unauthorised foreign grape varieties in an unrecognised area.
Exactly. But it became so popular, you know, and spawned so many followers in the region that the authorities, you know, ended up having to create various new official DOC appellations to embrace this new wave, the culmination of which was the DOC Bolgheri Sassicaia, the only DOC appellation in Italy dedicated to just one single wine estate.
Okay, so at this point, I want to bring in our first guest. Priscilla Incisa della Rocchetta is the granddaughter of Mario and daughter of Niccolo, who guided the estate over many years. She is one of five cousins who own and run the estate today. Apparently very amicably, which sounds like a serious achievement given the way most families tend to work.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Anyway, I caught up with her in London after an intriguing vertical tasting, more on which in a bit, and I asked her first to tell us about the story behind Sassicaia.
Well, originally Tenuta San Guido belonged to a very ancient Tuscan family called Della Gherardesca, where our grandmother was coming from. And Mario Incisa della Rocchetta, my grandfather, married into this family in 1930 when he married my grandmother Clarice. And as a couple, they moved to Bolgheri and established themselves there with their children during the war. And Bolgheri being a traditional agricultural estate mainly, we used to produce always like different kind of crops and olive oil. And we started with the horses around the 1930s. And the wine arrived just slightly after, because the first vineyard that he planted was in 1942. And he decided to experiment in the area of Bolgheri on the grounds of Tenuta San Guido with international grape varieties, notably Cabernet Sauvignon and then later also Cabernet Franc, because his intention was to produce a wine that he liked. He was very much in love with wines from the Bordeaux region. So he thought that he was going to make a wine in Bolgheri that would resemble these kind of wines. That's why he started this experiment. But for the first 20 years about, Sassicaia stayed a wine for the family and friends, because when he started, our grandfather didn't have the intention of producing something for the market. So the wine had to stay in the family for the beginning.
And I know that, you know, Sassicaia, it wasn't a wine that launched at the beginning to great acclaim. Do you think that was because people didn't really understand it?
Well, at the beginning, it was difficult to understand the fact that somebody from Piemonte would come to Tuscany, not even in the classic wine regions of Tuscany, but on the coast in Maremma, where it was unthinkable at the time to produce any kind of good quality wines, and based on international grape varieties was even more a curiosity. And in that sense, our grandfather was really a pioneer, because he kind of uncovered a new region for producing wine in Tuscany of high quality.
And was it also in part to do with the fact that people were used to Sangiovese, which was a bit earlier drinking, and Cabernet really just took time.
Yes, it was also, he was also applying different techniques of viticulture, and also he was using the barriques, the French barriques, to age this wine. So all things that were new to that area. And therefore, I guess it took about 20 years of experiments for people to understand that the wine then, when it was put on the side and aged, was actually becoming better, improving. And actually the first vintage that then ended up on the market was the 1968. So over 20 years of experiments.
The price of Sassicaia is pretty high these days. How do you feel about that?
Well, there's a question about offer and demand. The production is limited, so the prices have gone up in the years. We try to stay constant on our release price, so we don't have the price adapting to the kind of vintage or scores or anything like that. We keep the prices quite balanced year after year with a slight increase, but always quite straightforward.
Do you have a favorite vintage?
Well, it's a tricky question.
It is, I know.
Like you asked me, what is your favorite child? No. I personally am more inclined to like more fresh vintages, like, 14, 16, and this kind of vintages, yes, as opposed to maybe more opulent ones. But it's, like you say, it's a question of taste. So it's in wine, it's also interesting because there are different vintages that have different styles, and also people can choose for themselves what they like best.
I think even in an opulent vintage, Sassicaia always retains its elegance.
Yes, that is a bit the distinctive mark of Sassicaia, to manage to come up with elegant wines even in a challenging vintage, yes.
So Sassicaia is undoubtedly, you know, one of the finest Cabernets, if not one of the finest wines in the world. How do you feel about being in charge of the legacy, that legacy?
Well, I am luckily not alone, because I am just one part of my family. We are a group of five cousins, and we are supported by Carlo Paoli and other managers that are very knowledgeable, and they are really accompanying this new generation through the transition. And also, you know, as this is a family enterprise, a family company, we are looking at things really in the long run. So already thinking of the next generation, so our children. So it's a very, very exciting project. Of course, you have a lot of rewards and a lot of satisfaction, but it's also a big legacy to carry forward, so a lot of responsibility that comes with it.
Do you ever disagree about things?
No. We are actually not really disagreeing. It's very stimulating to have discussions and find consensus about things.
Now, iconic wines in general tend to have a certain mystique surrounding them. Can you tell me a bit more about the human, everyday side of Sassicaia? You know, what are the day-to-day priorities? What are the concerns? What are the challenges?
As you know, it's a pretty big estate, which is carrying forward several activities at the same time. But of course, the wine has become slowly the main focus, but not the only one. So in an everyday normal work activity, we look after many issues that turn around the wine. But of course, there's also people who are looking after the horses. We have a trainer, we have a stud manager. And then there's a little team that looks after the wildlife refuge, because also that needs to be taken care of and a lot of attention. We have visitors. So there is a lot going on. It's like a little, actually not so little, it's like a big family, where everybody has their roles, and we interact with each other, and we take care of all these different pillars that make part of Tenuta Sanguigna.
And what makes Sassicaia special?
I guess it's special in a way that it's a bit mysterious. There's always been a bit of mystery around this wine that has come out of the blue in a region that was not considered interesting for producing good quality wines. And it's also wine that has stayed true to itself without following fashions or anything like that, with a style that is recognizable across the vintages. And people just fell in love with not only the wine itself, but also the story, the philosophy. And also it's consistent in terms of quality. So people can rely on the fact that they will not be deceived by the bottles.
Now, you're Italian family. You're never going to make a wine that isn't food friendly. Do you have a favourite dish that you love to drink, to eat with Sassicaia?
I would drink Sassicaia. I would advise to pair it, of course, with food from our region, because it's more natural to think of nice meat from Toscana, or venison, or some nice cheeses. But also, depending on the vintages, maybe in the cooler, fresher vintages, it's also easily combinable with some nice fish, a bit fatty fish, or cooked in the Mediterranean way with some tomatoes. And we are right by the sea, so we are very spoiled. We have very good seafood, and as well very good venison, wild boars and cows. And
can I just touch for a moment on fakes, which are very much an issue these days, particularly with these kind of iconic wines? I know the police broke up a fake Sassicaia ring 3 or 4 years ago. How do you feel about that, and what are you doing to try to prevent that kind of thing happening?
Well, it's on one hand, if they are copying our product, it means that the product is sought after, which is always a good news. Of course, it's not good to think that there might be bottles out there that contain something which we don't know how it was produced. It might be harmful for the consumers who by mistake buy a bottle that is not the real thing. So we advise to always source the wines from the primary source, either from the importer or from at least a safe source. We do have some things that we have introduced on the bottles, like the name of Sassicaia or Guidalberto are embossed on top of the bottle, on top of the label. Below, we have the writing Tenuta San Guido, and then other things that I'm actually not allowed to say. But we have ways to see if the bottle is a fake or not. The problem is that maybe some bottles pop up in a faraway country, and unless the consumer gets suspicious and brings it up to either the importer or somebody who knows the product very well. But the Italian police is very, very much active, and so they try to do their best. And often they find these people.
How would you describe Sassicaia in 3 words?
I would say it's Sassicaia. I would describe it as elegant, unique, and I don't know. I can't say just one word. I would say true to its territory, true to its philosophy, true to itself. And
Priscilla, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Elegant, unique, true to itself. Sounds a bit like you, darling. No reaction. There we go. Oh, she's taking a compliment.
I think it's a compliment.
Anyway, back to the wine. The experiment that worked. You know, it's a great story, isn't it?
It is. Now, there were a couple of things we got into there that we didn't preface. Carlo Paoli, who Priscilla mentioned, has been technical director of the estate since 2009, in charge of a team of 10 people who make the wine. And everyone you talk to speaks very highly of him and his overall winemaking ethos, which is all about purity and precision.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like he's kind of upped the quality even further, doesn't it? And he's a disciple of Giacomo Tacchi's.
Yeah. I mean, I think the winemaking ethos at San Guido is still very much based on the fundamental principles that Tacchi's espoused. Yeah, he was a great thinker, had so much experience. Mm. So it's not really changed, but just evolved over time, perhaps, you know, been perfected.
Yeah. And she also mentioned Guidalberto, didn't she?
We haven't touched on that yet, have we? So Sassicaia is just one wine made at Tenuta San Guido, the original, if you like. A blend typically of 85% Cabernet Sauvignon with 15% Cabernet Franc. Mm. Now, in 2000, they introduced Guidalberto, a blend of majority Cabernet Sauvignon with 40% Merlot. Mm. And then in 2002, they added Le Defese, a Cabernet Sauvignon blended with Sangiovese. So, those are the three wines in the Tenuta San Guido wine stable, as opposed to the horse stable.
Lots of horses in those, yeah. but so you basically got, you know, Sassicaia, Cabernet Sauvignon mainly with Cabernet Franc. Mm. All the wines are based around Cabernet Sauvignon, but then you've got Guidalberto with a bit of Merlot and then Defese with a bit of Sangiovese. Okay.
Yeah,
and Guidalberto, incidentally, is getting pretty serious these days, isn't it? Anyway,
yeah.
Now, you also touched on fakes.
Yeah, so as we all know, sadly, the incidence of fraud in fine wine has become more common because there's good money to be
all
made as the value of these wines goes up. And back in 2020, two people were arrested for allegedly selling counterfeit bottles of Sassicaia to the value of €2 million.
Wow.
The arrests were the result of a long investigation, and apparently this gang had been using Sicilian wine, bottles from Turkey and fake labels from Bulgaria, and then flogging them in Korea, China, Russia at 70% below market value.
Oh my God, if something's too good to be true.
I mean, totally. Anyway, the police intercepted a delivery of 41 cases of fake Sassicaia 2015. Apparently this gang was selling about 700 cases of this per month out of a warehouse near Milan.
So hence them getting serious, hence the estate getting serious about fighting fraud, you know, as Priscilla mentioned.
Absolutely. You know, producers have to engage with this, sad as it is. Caveat emptor, buy or beware.
Yeah.
And as Priscilla says, it's always best, you know, to buy from reputable sources. On which note, next up, we're going to hear from Brett and Nico of San Guido's UK importers, Armit Wines. Two people who aren't shy with their opinions. and we're also going to be talking about our favourite vintages too. By way of brief recap, Sassicaia began life as a home consumption experiment to recreate claret in a Tuscan coastal backwater. It has since grown into a global wine phenomenon, which is, of course, entirely admirable, but comes with its own set of realities and challenges.
Yeah, and that's what we want to get into, get a feel for now. Brett Fleming is MD of Armit, who work closely with Tenuta San Guido and who tend to set the global commercial tempo for the estate, if I can put it like that. Brett's a Kiwi wine producer by background and an experienced wine trade stalwart. And he's instigated a change in tactics vis-a-vis Sassicaia.
Yeah, part of this strategy has basically seen investors or traders shunned in favour of collectors and top restaurants. Fleming reckons this move has cost his company about £3 million in lost trade. But he says it was worth it to get the wine into places it works best. He's also just launched a new project to hold wines back for late release to top restaurants.
Yeah, he's also, perhaps more controversially, upped the release price. The 2016 Sassicaia, a 100 Parker Point wine, was released at £650 for a six-pack. This was in 2019, and apparently 24 hours after release, it was trading on the secondary market for £1,400. So with San Guido, he decided to up the initial release price to protect those profits, to the extent that the 2021 vintage, released in February 2024, was £1,250 for six.
Pretty much a doubling of price in 5 years.
Exactly.
Now, that's quite punchy, isn't
it? It is.
Seriously.
Now, Fleming says it's not about being greedy. It's about recognising the position, that the reality of where Sassicaia is in the market. He says people can still buy it and it tends to go up in value. So it is a good investment. Apparently the 2021 was selling for £1,700 a few weeks after release. So anyone who bought it at, you know, £1,250 would have made over £400. Plus he maintains that if you compare it to top Bordeaux, Burgundy, Piedmont, it still represents good value for money. He says it's the market, not him, that dictates the price.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, and I suppose you can argue that it does represent value in the context, but that's partly a reflection of how mad prices for top wines are now.
That's true.
And you have to say, you know, it was even better value 5 years ago, wasn't it?
Quite. The benefit of hindsight. Oh. Why didn't we pile in? Anyway, I had a long chat with Brett. I get the feeling most chats with Brett are quite long, actually.
He likes to chat.
They're not short. And on the subject of pricing, I asked him whether the cost of living crisis and the difficult trading times had affected Sassicaia.
Absolutely. We've seen a definite decline in the demand by our current customer base. So where we would offer, say, 4 6-packs to a customer, they're not saying no, they're saying, I'll only take two. I am generalizing. There are many high net worths who, frankly, want more and will spend more. But it's not just private clients. That's the restaurant trade particularly. We've seen retail impacted massively. But what it's allowed us to do is we've got a very big list of people who've not been able to buy Sassicaia that we're now able to service. And in fact, because we really want to spread the love, we don't want it focused on the same people all the time. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. It's Sassicaia. It's an expensive bottle of wine. But in the world of fine wine, in the world of icon wine, it still offers very, very good value for money. When you look at, I don't want to mention names because I don't want to get in trouble, but if you go to any Michelin star restaurant and pull out the wine list, you will see that San Guido Sassicaia is not the most expensive wine on the list. Not even close. It would be mid-priced compared to many of the other ones on there, dominated by Bordeaux and Burgundy, of course. I'm not justifying, therefore, the price, but it is wrong to say that it's so expensive that nobody can get access to it. It's not aimed at everybody. It's aimed at the elite. It is, by definition, an icon fine wine, you know.
So you would describe Sassicaia as an iconic fine wine or an icon fine wine?
Personally, I think it's an icon estate. How San Guido was established, how Sassicaia was established, was not for the benefit to make money. It was established for the family. And Gisa de la Rochetta wanted to replicate his love of Bordeaux in Bogli. So now it's an iconic estate. And the development of the more commercial side was almost by accident. It wasn't sought after. Many of the estates will use a piece of art or a piece of music or affiliate themselves with something of the region. Whereas San Guido, it's all about the terroir. It's all about the estate. So it's the market that's decided it's iconic. It's not San Guido that decided it's iconic.
And do you think that's part of its appeal, that it Absolutely. Wasn't nakedly Yes. commercial, it wasn't ambitious, it was actually just a great wine that happened almost by accident?
Yes, I think that's exactly the appeal. Also, the people, I mean, they are amongst the most lovely people I deal with. They're the most humble, down-to-earth producers. Carlo Poli would be one of, you know, if I'm honest, if I can be remembered when I'm gone and half the way that Carlo will be remembered, I'd have done good in this world. He's the most remarkable, humble man. And that is the same with Priscilla. It's the same with the whole family. They're just a joy to work with. You know, when you go to other estates, it's all bells and whistles. It's stainless steel and it's art and it's, you know, it's like going to California and you know, these amazing estates. Sassicaia has always been about the terroir it makes the wine from. It has never been about anything else. And the other thing to San Guido, the wine was not the biggest part of their operation. The equine business was. Horse racing is very dear to them. The whole wine thing became almost an embarrassment in terms of their success. So how it's managed and bringing in all the marketing people, that's just not what they do. And of course, you're right, that is the charm. They are, and you see it in the wine, this extraordinary freshness and beauty of their wine. It's not forced, it is quite literally the terroir.
If I could offer you a bottle of Sassicaia and something to eat it with, what vintage would it be and what would the food be on your plate?
That's a tough question. That's a very tough question. I can answer the food slightly easier. I think it goes particularly well with lamb, lamb chops, and definitely cheese, of course. But the best way for me, honestly, the best Sassicaias I've had, without mentioning a vintage, have been when I've been in very good company and we want to open a really nice bottle of mature red wine and simply watch it evolve in the glass and enjoy it with great company. I know everybody talks about the 16 because of the 100 points, but personally, I think 19 is a better wine. It's more finesse, it's more elegant. 16 is more robust. It's a bigger wine. It's a bigger structure. But it's ultimately it's personal taste. I think the 2021 will become truly one of the greatest Sassicaias ever made. I think it's good or good as, if not better, than the 85, which was the legendary vintage. It's a slightly different style since Carlo joined the business. He's really focused on that purity, that focus of expression of fruit. We talked about elements of it, the elegance, the freshness, the makeup of it. But I think the master of that is the 21. I truly believe it's going to go down as one of the greatest vintages ever made. 23 is also looking pretty smart. Carlo reckons the 23 would be like the 21, but that's still a couple of years away.
Great tip. I'm sorry, if I push you on the vintage, I'm opening a bottle right now. What am I opening for you? Come on, Brett.
21.
Brett, thank you very much.
No, my pleasure. My pleasure.
When do we get to choose our favourite vintages?
Yeah, in a bit, coming on to it. And of course, a good merchant would always choose the latest release to push, wouldn't they?
Absolutely.
But I'm interested, what do you think of the pricing and commercial strategy?
I mean, I think it's understandable, isn't it? You know, as a wine lover, you want these wines to be affordable,
yeah.
Or rather not entirely out of reach if it's a really special purchase. So £200 a bottle is much more of a stretch than £100. But it's also true, it's nowhere near what some of the other top estates are charging. Mm. And if that's what it's being traded for anyway, you can understand it.
Yeah. It's spenny though, isn't it? It's a big price. But it's a pretty special wine as well, isn't it? You know, it's not cheap, but it's special. We're going to come on to this anyway, the wine itself. But first, picking up on the issue of pricing and uniqueness, I wanted to bring in Master Sommelier Nicolas Clerc, who works with Armit, to pick a sommelier's brain about all this. And I asked him for his take on Sassicaia.
Well, Sassicaia, it's first of all, it's an icon, you know. People are looking at that wine as certainly one of the most iconic wine of Italy. Because I know them a bit now, I think it's mostly, well, of course, the quality of the wine, but as well the people. I guess it's very important. Family-owned, down to earth. Very little marketing, very little communication, but the bottle and the glass talk, the wine talk by itself, basically. There's something there. There's something. Sassicaia is there for a reason, for the quality and for the people, I guess. If you think about what is Sassicaia, the vineyard, the heart of Sassicaia, the hillside, the Cabernet Franc, the north-facing part of the vineyard, on hill. There's something quite unique there. Yeah, Sassicaia is unique. And nowadays, you know, there is unfortunately less and less French sommelier and more Italian top sommelier. And I mean, you walk into a restaurant with a bottle of Sassicaia, and they all start to kiss each other, blah, 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 blah. So it's quite impressive.
How would you
to put that on your interview.
That's going in. How would you describe Sassicaia in the glass?
I think what defines Sassicaia, it's the freshness, tension, the precision. It's year on, it's always an elegant wine. You take an example of 17, for example, which was a scorching vintage, very, very warm. It's still very elegant and retains some freshness.
How best to serve it?
The good thing with Sassicaia, it's on the release, more or less after 2 years, it's always approachable. So you can drink it after 5 years, but you can drink it after 20 or plus. It's a wine need to breathe, it need decantation, particularly if it's a young vintage. It will need a larger glass, Bordeaux style or glass, and yeah, if it can be aerated 1 hour before you truly enjoy it, you should be here for a memorable moment, yes. So,
and in terms of aging and it closing down, you said you can drink it young. Would there be a general rule of thumb of when, you know, it's good to drink it before and then after, as it were?
One of my recent favorite vintages is 19. He has started to close down. But a year ago, he was fully open, pretty, in your face straight away. So it's, after 3 years, 3 to 5, then it starts to close down and reopen maybe after 8, 9, 10 years.
8, 9, 10. So maybe it closed down after 5,
yeah.
Come back to it after 10. Exactly. How have you seen Sassicaia, the wine, evolve over your time in the trade?
There's two evolutions. Evolution of fame, and which I think 15 vintage kick off everything, basically, André Saint-Hyères. There is a change of precision winemaking, which I attribute to Carlo Paoli. I do believe that the tannic structure is far more refined than it used to be before 09, basically, before its first vintage. Is tannins are different, the grips, precision, there's something very, very different there.
And how do you feel about the price? Because obviously the price has gone up quite a bit lately.
The price I've raised, I think it's been a bit of a repositioning. And to be fair, it's still very much, it is at the right price. And it's, but no, I do think it's still present for a fair value still within its category. But it's a wine as well, which is very difficult to categorize as well.
If I give you any vintage and any food, what would it be?
It would be 19 vintage, but I think 21 is better. but it's too early. And food-wise, I don't know. Last month, when we launched 21, we had 19 and 16 at Mount Street Restaurant, and they've got a lobster pie there, which is to die for. So I will go back to that.
So Sasakaya 2019 with lobster pie.
Yeah.
Nico, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure. Time to win, no?
It's all about the pleasure.
Sasakaya and lobster pie. Now that I have to try.
Do you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of Desperate Dan. Do you remember Desperate Dan and his cow pie in the Dandy comic? You know, I'm seeing
cow
sort of
pie.
I'm seeing lobster claws sticking out of the top. and I just, oh, what, it sounds amazing, doesn't it?
It sounds completely delicious, yeah, doesn't it? Yeah. And actually interesting, both he and Priscilla recommend Sasakaya with seafood dishes.
Really,
you know?
Interesting,
that, I think that reflects the style of the wine, which is, yeah, you know, fundamentally an elegant red wine. Yeah. It's not a shouty, brash, super ripe, high alcohol show-off. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a wine that isn't afraid to be mezzo forte, to be beautifully medium weight, but still tremendously complex and resonant and long, yeah, and layered, yeah, and, yeah, you know, like all the very best reds, to be honest.
I totally could not agree more. And we'll maybe come on to this in a moment when we talk about our favourite vintages. But in terms of the style, it was interesting what Nico said about the wine being approachable on release, you know, after, say, 2.5 years, then tending to close down after, you know, 3 to 5 years, then coming back with 8, 9, 10 years of bottle age, like many great wines do, you know, to be honest. And then with a bit of maturity, it can be just stunning.
As we've been lucky enough to experience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But just before we get into that, I picked up on the two key milestones in Sasakaya's recent evolution, he pinpointed.
Yeah.
You know, the new winemaking regime under Carlo Paoli that began in 2009 and has meant more refinement and precision, as we've already mentioned. And also the time it really entered the global halls of fame from 2015. Yeah. Onwards.
And he also mentioned the vineyards, which we don't talk about enough in terms of Sasakaya. You know, the estate does have a brilliant map, actually, if you can find it, showing how the estate lands extend back from the flat coastal lands near the famous cypress-lined avenue into Bulgari, into the hills southeast of Bulgari, where some of the most historic top vineyards are, these amazing hills. And, you know, the very best vineyards are on very specific soils. You know, it's only 4% of the 2,500-hectare estate that is actually vine. So it's only on very specific areas, specific soils, exposures, altitudes, some of which are up to 300 metres above sea level. And there are plenty of woods around to refresh the atmosphere too. Mm. So it's an interesting, you know,
it is,
terroir, as it were.
Now, I think we need to talk about the wines, don't we?
We do. Good point. So, you know, I looked at our notes and I realised something that was a bit of a revelation.
Go on, what is it?
And that is that we have been lucky enough to try 17 different vintages of Sasakaya, not counting the same vintages on different occasions, absolutely. And not counting the ones we've enjoyed so much we don't remember them.
Oh,
which is always a factor.
I'm not guilty. I'm admitting nothing.
No, okay, right. You're selling me out.
Wouldn't
selling
dream
me
of
down
it.
The road. Okay, fine, whatever. Well, either way, I think we should maybe just very quickly, by way of finale, choose our three favourite Sassicaia vintages.
Okay.
And they all have to be different, okay? So you go first.
Okay, gladly. I will kick off with the 2011, which we had when we visited the estate back in 2014, and then which I had in a vertical tasting for the release of the 2021 vintage in February 24. You know, I liked it both times, but in this latest tasting, it was in a Magnum, and it just sang, you know, beautifully aged with dried fruit and a real irony character. You know, this was a warm vintage, but the wine is still so fresh and with gorgeous tension and length. Yeah, just beautiful. And to my mind, more compelling than the highly praised 2016. But anyway, your go.
Interesting. Controversial. Okay, so I will then dovetail nicely with you because I'm going to mention the 2021 vintage, which we both just tasted.
I would have had that one.
Just been released. Okay, there we go. I think this is going to be a sensational wine
totally
in the future.
Totally agree.
Do you agree? Yeah. Okay, brilliant. It's just so fine, isn't it? So intense and complete. But, you know, as you said, it isn't shouty. It's happy to be gracefully mezzo forte. You know, flavours of roasted pepper and fresh cassis, wood smoke. It's just so pure and refined. You know, I use the word serene a lot in my notes. You know, definitely a superstar of the future.
Okay, so you go future, I'm going past. In our vertical, we also tasted the 1998. It's not quite as old, obviously, as the 1988 Magnum I had back in 2006 with Niccolò, which was joyous and I think one of Niccolò's favourite wines. But the 1998 was perfectly mature. It was luscious and resolved. It doesn't have the tension of the 2011. It feels like it's from a different era, but it's gorgeous all the same, you know, with that fabulous maturity. It needs drinking. And if anyone needs a hand...
drinking
I'm here.
You're putting yourself nobly forward, aren't you? Okay, well, I see your 1998 and I raise you a 1996 Magnum, which I had back in 2012 at a premium Familiae Vini event, you know, that gang of top producers, including Mouton Rothschild, Egon Müller, Vegas City, you know. Now, I mentioned this one precisely because it wasn't obvious. You know, it actually started off quite slow. It was sort of peaty and earthy. It was a bit unfriendly initially when we tasted it. But then it really opened up with notes of dried fruit, tobacco, and I don't know, just like sort of peppers on a fireside grill. It just had lovely structure and resonance. And then it went beautifully with a monkfish loin with pork and lentils, which is pretty tasty, no? And again, another seafood.
Yeah, time. gosh. So where do I go from that? I've got a friendly one. So this is my last choice. I'm going for the 2015 vintage, which I tasted back in 2018, and it was bewitching. You know, so complex. All the roasted pepper, cassis, cedar, and fresh dark fruit you'd expect, but also with a floral, almost potpourri richness to the aromatics. Then wonderful, you know, succulents, fine texture, perfectly balanced. I literally just wrote, "Want to swallow."
Sounds like
you're not really allowed to do when you're tasting, are you?
And for my final choice, I'm going to cheat. You'd be disappointed if I didn't.
Of course I would.
And I'm going to go for two.
You can't go for two. That's unfair.
That's why I let you go first. So I was going to have the last.
It's like getting two penalties at the end of a football match.
There we go. That's me. If you ever see me stepping up in the World Cup finals, you know I'm going to have two. Anyway, the first is the 2019, which I tasted a few years back, and just has the tannins to die for. Totally classic and fine and noble, but very discreet and insistent and just yum. And then also the 2010 in Magnum, which I tried on the same occasion as the 2019. That was just stunning too. It just leapt out of the glass with sort of wood smoke, tobacco, curry leaf, roasted cherry, sort of floral hints. And then it's just seamless and layered and gravelly and long on the palate. The Lafitte of Bulgari, I wrote.
No mention of swallowing?
None.
I'll just have to assume that was the case.
Yeah, I would.
Yeah. Anyway, that's it for Sassicaia. Our time is up. We hope you've enjoyed this thoroughbred Italian adventure. By way of closing summary, Sassicaia is a pioneering wine that blazed a trail for fine Bordeaux-style reds in coastal Tuscany. Originally conceived as a humble house wine for friends and family, when it finally went on the market, wine lovers around the world received Sassicaia with open arms and raised it to the lofty status of global icon. Its price tag has risen to match of late. That's something that hasn't escaped the attention of fraudsters. But over time, the wine has stayed admirably true to its roots, an elegant style some might even call old school, but only in the very best sense.
Absolutely. And a great match for lobster pie, we're assured. Our thanks to Priscilla Incisa della Rocchetta, Brett Fleming and Nicola Clerc. Also to Jonathan White at Armit. If you've liked this episode, please do leave us a rating and review. Meantime, thanks again for joining us. And until next time, cheers.